going to stand too. That's the Burns sisters. First of all, let me tell you who I am. My name is Sharon Griffiths, and the name of the show is Heresy. It's a new show on BAI. It's a feminist, literary, arts, and heretical show. I looked up heresy in the dictionary because I was afraid it had too many religious overtones. And the second definition, as far as, I think I was looking in Webster's, was a political, religious, philosophical doctrine that, I'm paraphrasing, that goes against the norm. And that's me all over, let me tell you. This show will be heard on the, I believe, second, fourth, and if there is a fifth Sunday of every month. And I haven't, this is sort of a mélange show, one that has been thrown together rather hastily, but they will straighten out and fly right. I have actual folio copy in for March. One of the favors that the program director did for me was to put me on March 10th, which in the UK is known as Mothering Sunday. We have our Mother's Day in May. The UK has theirs in March. And one of the things I'm going to talk about on that show is mothering. Mothering in the 90s. Mothering at the age of 40, which is possible these days. Mothering, you can even conceivably, pardon the pun, have a child after menopause at this point. They can inject you with, they can just stuff you full of hormones and make you able to conceive. And I think the thought absolutely terrifies me. One used to think of menopause as a blessing because there would be no more babies. But that doesn't seem to be the case these days. Anyway, let me talk a little bit about what you just heard. I got this album by the Burns Sisters, and it's just called the Burns Sisters Band, from probably a thrift shop, knowing me. And I looked at the cover, and the cover shows these five very lovely women, all sisters, obviously, because they resemble each other, wearing really chic clothes. Actually, there's a credit somewhere in here, I think it's on the inner sleeve, for their fashion direction, or the person who did all the, where they got all their clothes and all their jewelry. And of course, this goes sort of against what I stand for, or what I don't stand for it. But I looked at it, and I said, oh, look, it's a girl group, and I'm particularly fond of girl groups. So I bought it, even though there are songs on it like Take Me Tonight, Who's Gonna Dance With Me, I Need Your Love. And most of them sound exactly as they are titled. They're very middle-of-the-road pop. They've never made a video that I know of, but then again, I don't watch video programs. They're pretty enough to, for sure, but I've never seen them. And then at the very end of the album, I see that they do I'm Gonna Stand. Now, I'm Gonna Stand is by Sweet Honey and the Rock. It's a wonderful a cappella song that they do. And these women do it too. And it just seems so incongruous to be on this album. So I'm going to use that, I believe, as my ID, my intro to this particular show, which again is called Heresy. And for all of Paul Wonder's audience, if you're all out there, Paul has moved, let me find out where.
Saturday at 4:30.
Saturdays at 4:30 in the afternoon. The man is actually going to be on when the sun is out. Oh my God. Okay. It's going to be unusual. But Paul does a wonderful show many a time. Back in about 1982 or so, I was working night shifts as a computer operator, And he saved my life, because I'd be sitting there watching tapes go round and round. And if you think looking at your laundry go around in the dryer is boring, watching a tape go around on a tape drive that's attached to a computer is just about equal to that. And I'd have to do that for 7 hours a night. And I would listen to soundtrack, and he would make me feel a lot better. It was very entertaining. So I wish him luck in his new time slot, and I'm real glad to get this one because it's a much easier time for me to be here. I'm actually awake, and I can actually sleep afterwards. That always helps. I haven't been on the air for almost exactly a year and a half, and it doesn't seem that long, but it's true. My old show was called Cosmic Debris, and it got to a point in my life where things were just too busy for me to do the show up to my best capabilities, so I had to let it go. Now, actually, Cosmic Debris has followed me, or I have followed it, into this time slot. Rocky and Pandora, who do Cosmic Debris now, are going to be doing one issue of it, one edition of it, once a month on the first Sunday of the month in this time slot. And the other person who is in here is someone I am not familiar with. His name is Paul... I keep thinking his name is Paul Ruiz, but it's not. It's Paul Ruentz, something like that. And he will be on the third Sunday of the month. So if things are a little confused for a while, bear with us all. It should straighten out real soon. I'm only on once this month, actually, in February. And I'll be back on March 10th. Some major events have happened in my life since I've been here. My mother died, which was a real heavy thing for me. It was heavier than when my father died, which was back in 1979. I moved to what I laughingly refer to as the mainland, since we are on an island. I moved to New Jersey. It's one of the nicer things to call New Jersey is the mainland. And I live now, after living in apartments all of my life, I'm now living in a two-family house. And that has its interesting sides, too, like this afternoon. I was preparing my show and pulling my records in my attic. I've never had an attic before. It's very interesting. It's hard enough to get up and down from it, but it's very nice to have that sort of musty, dark, pointed space to go up and hide in every now and again. I understand the fascination that the little kids have with attics now. I was married, and of course, it can be difficult to resolve being a married feminist. They are not mutually exclusive terms, as long as you have the right attitude about it. I was married on October 14th of 1990 at a VFW hall, Veterans of Foreign Wars Hall, in a little town in Jersey by the mayor of that little town. And it was very neat. Our bunch of our best friends played, a very good band, played for the wedding, and we invited a lot of great people. And it's funny now because this is the first time I've ever been married, and I'm about to be 36. I will be 36 at the end of April. And I work with a diversity of women. I work only with women at my job. And most of them are in their 50s or late 40s, but some of them are in their 20s. And here I am practically right in the middle at the age of 36. And the younger ones have asked me more than once now, what's it really like to be married? And how can you, one of the women who's rather fiercely independent and eccentric says, how can you live with somebody with your habits, with, you know, because everybody has their own bad habits or whatever. And I say, It's different for everybody, but what you have to do, I've become quite a philosopher at my age. What you have to do is you have to find a person whose eccentricities and bad habits match or complement yours, or that you can stand. Some people have habits I cannot stand, but my husband's habits are okay. I can live with them. So that's the grand philosophy from me on marriage, on being married. And when I was talking to the program director about doing this show, I realized how well prepared I feel to do a women's show. I have been a woman all my life. I have been a feminist since the age of 15, which was in 1970, which is when the women's liberation movement finally pulled itself away and became born from the male New Left, which was, of course, a large anti-war and anti-establishment and hippie movement and leftist political movement. And it spawned the women's liberation movement the same way the anti-slavery movement spawned the suffrage movement, the votes for women movement. And I always find that fascinating, how history repeats itself and how women always seem to need to pull away from a mixed sex cause or from a mixed sex group, because being in that group seems to point up to them what exactly is wrong in their lives. And I think that's neat, because it's a pretty clear-cut repetition of history between the anti-slavery movement spawning suffrage and the New Left spawning the women's movement of the 70s. And another thing I'm going to be talking about here often, because it's a big question in my life, is where has all that gone and why? So that will be coming up. Working with the women I work with, that's a really brilliant sentence, has brought a lot of other factors out, beside my being so well prepared to do this show as a woman and as a thinking person for all this time. I now work very closely with two women who have been a major influence over me in the past year and a half, because I started working at this place just about the time I left my old show. One of them is a very devout Sufi Muslim, which is different than the Sunni Muslims who are in Iran. It's another sect of Islam. And she is also a very devout feminist. And how she reconciles those two, it's probably the same way I reconcile being a married feminist. You can do it. You can reconcile the most different things, the most opposite factions in your life, as long as you know that they are in your life and you are the uniting force between the two. You can build the bridge. That's how I feel anyway, and that's how she feels, I believe. I don't want to put words in her mouth. And the other woman that I work with is married to a man who was born and raised and only recently came here to the United States from Peru. And she's fluent in Spanish. She has traveled extensively in Central and South America. So from her, I get a Latino perspective to women and to feminism. And from the other woman, I get a more Afrocentric perspective on feminism. Because in my last incarnation here at BAI, I was trying to do more women's literature, women's poetry, even though I'm kind of a bad reader of poetry. And I felt intimidated, with my background and my culture and my race, I felt intimidated doing an Alice Walker story or a Maya Angelou story or Maya Angelou poem. But now I don't feel that way anymore. I feel that sex goes a lot deeper than race and culture and ethnicity, that there's a commonality to it. And if I can bring it out, if I can bring it to people, that's fine. That's wonderful. I want to do that. So there will be a lot of, maybe not a lot of, but a fair share of third world representation, Latina and African-American representation on this show, as far as literature is concerned, at least. I'm not that familiar with women's music in that vein, but I'll try. I'm just trying like everybody else. One of the things I wanted to talk about on this show, and one of the things that is on just about everybody's mind, both here at the station and out there in the real world, if you can call it that, is what's going on in the Persian Gulf, the conflict, the military operation. They're calling it everything but a formally declared war, because it's not a formally declared war as far as I know. The difference, see, I've only been through one other war. I'm relatively inexperienced. I mean, besides Panama and Grenada, which to me just don't count. They count for the families of the people who died there, certainly, but it was not, it didn't make enough impact on the media, on anybody's life that I know, to be called a war or an operation or a conflict or whatever you want to call it. So the one I'm talking about is Vietnam, where I was growing up. I was an impressionable adolescent at the time. And of course, I went on the anti-war marches. And of course, I went, our high school was striking at the time. There were massive high school, college strikes at that point. And of course, I went on them. And I did my politically correct duty by going to take alternative high school courses down at the new school, because that's where they were being offered. And, you know, so I paid my political dues. I was not happy doing it. It didn't feel comfortable to me. I didn't feel like I had a handle on anything that was going on, partially because even though the movement was very organized at the top, it was very disorganized at the bottom. It was a basic pyramid. There were the leaders. It was a very capitalistic hierarchy. There were the leaders and there were the followers, and there were a lot more followers than leaders, and I was one of the followers. I was thinking about this incident, this conflict now, in terms of Vietnam, because that's the only frame of reference I have. And a couple of important things occurred to me. The fact that, well, first of all, as I mentioned earlier, that the Vietnam War sparked the formation of, or if not the formation, the growth of the new left. And that in turn sparked the birth of the women's movement. And that's something that we all have to remember and think on as we go forward. The other thing that I realized was that there was no such thing as a formal start date for Vietnam. You notice that too? That it just kind of slid on in before we were, it kind of caught us unaware at one point. There were advisors. There was all sorts of covert stuff going on. And that, again, as in the Saudi Arabian conflict, is a half a world at least away. Very far removed from us. And we only heard what they wanted us to hear. And they is a big topic of mine, and I will talk about that on some future show. The very fact that this war has a formal start date is enough to remind you this is truly a war of the 90s. My friend Sydney and I were just talking, Sydney Smith, who will be on this coming Monday morning at 1 a.m. for the first time in a long time. We're both old hands here who are coming back. We were just talking in the other room, and he was telling me about where he was when he heard about this formal declaration or formal start date of the conflict. Because remember, it has not been declared, because Bush went over or under or around Congress to get this thing done. and Sidney was... I hope I'm not blowing his story for tomorrow night. He was in Tower Records at Lincoln Center when this happened, and he was buying CDs. And there's a bank of video monitors at Tower Records at Lincoln Center. And all of a sudden, all the video monitors switched from playing the music videos to news. And so there must have been, I can only imagine this because I've been there, but I wasn't there at that particular time. There must have been, you know, all the same heads popping up, like Max Headroom, all saying the same thing. And I thought, as he was explaining this to me, how fitting, how 90s, how high tech can we get? Because it's... You're standing in a store that sells only CDs, the cutting-edge technology, and you're watching multiple video color, you know, large color video monitors, and the men come up, of course they're men, talking about the war like little cookie-cutter people, all looking the same, all saying the same things. And it really, really struck me. And then I asked him, as a matter of information, where were you when you found out that President Kennedy was shot? And because I remember where I was. We were both in school. He's a little older than I am. And he heard about it. In social studies class, I said, what, did it come over the PA system? He said, we didn't have one. Somebody came to the door and told us. So that's how far we've come in less than 30 years. And it's scary. It's very, very scary. Technology seems to be snowballing at a rate that I just don't know where it's going. Because when you do a graph of man from the time we crawled out of the primordial sea to now, we have squeezed these technological advances into a state where they're happening every day. They're happening sometimes twice a day. Something incredibly important is either discovered or somehow happens, and that's very scary. But let me get back to the war, the conflict, the Operation Desert Storm. When I heard about all this going on, with the state of mind that I am in these days, which is a very feminist and very militant state of mind, the first thing that occurred to me is how masculine war is, and how what we as women, what women can do to stop the war. And this is a big question and a big problem for me. I'm thinking about it, I'm talking to people, and I'm not getting any specific answers because, again, we are not in the positions of power that we need to be in order to stop this. There's not enough representation in politics. There's not enough representation in the upper echelons of the armed forces. So we, the ever-patient wives and daughters and sisters at home, knitting for our boys overseas, are going to have to figure something out. And I just would like people to think on that. Women as well as men as well as women here. What can we do to stop it? I've been watching recently because I just got a VCR. I just joined the 20th century, the high-tech 90s. And I'm having a great deal of fun watching a lot of movies that I have already seen, but my husband has not. He didn't go to movies a lot, and he didn't have a VCR ever before, and I have done both. So I've seen a lot of these, and I'm seeing them through his eyes for the first time, so it's really a lot of fun. But one thing we have been watching, and one thing that he's rather obsessed with, is Vietnam. He is obsessed because of the hippie movement, the New Left, the fact that he volunteered to go into the army. He enlisted, and he was lucky enough to be standing at Fort Dix, I believe, with his orders to Vietnam in one hand and his discharge in the other. Circumstances just worked out that way, and I, for one, at this point in my life, am very glad that it did, because he would have probably either not come home or come home and been put directly into a rubber room, because that's just the kind of person he is. The movies that we've been seeing are movies that were made in the late 80s, the middle to late 80s, to portray Vietnam as a grotesque mistake, as a war that brought out the worst in everybody, the government, the armed forces, and the Vietnamese, as a, the war was portrayed as just about the most horrible thing that's ever come down the pike. And okay, I will believe that. I don't know that much, I haven't studied that much about it. Of course, now with the distance and clarity that time has given it, we are able to look at it a little more objectively than we did then, as someday, hopefully not in the too distant future, we will be able to look at what is going on right now with a little more clarity, a little more truth, a little less obfuscation, and see what this is, what is really happening there, who is really dying, how they are dying, and what is really behind all this, all the stuff that the media is not quite being totally upfront about right now. But the tendency Hollywood has at this point is to portray the Vietnam War as a serious mistake, as a hurtful and bad thing. Coming Home, Apocalypse Now, Full Metal Jacket, Platoon, and probably others, but those are the ones that I have either seen or have read about extensively. They've portrayed the war in this particular way. And one of the more unifying themes in all of these movies is there's always a scene where somebody snaps, where some grunt, some piece of cannon fodder, or they're too young, too inexperienced commanding officers, which was sort of a joke in those days, snaps.